a really important part of a meditation practice, and this is where the end of RAIN comes in, the non-attachment, the non-judgment, is to non-aggressively drop the ongoing conversation in our head and learn to joyfully come back to the present moment. And this sort of joyfully is kind of a challenge at times. And so I want to teach you a specific technique for cultivating joy, especially in the walking meditation, although we'll learn it in by sitting. You can apply it in walking. And it's also something that you can apply to many moments of your daily life in order to consciously nurture and build new neural pathways of joy. And it's a very simple technique, as most things are in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition. It comes from the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition. And it's a technique called the 10 breaths practice. And it comes from an ordained Dharma teacher in my root tradition, the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, by the name of Glenn Schneider. And he's actually written, it's a cute little book, and it's really worth taking a look at, especially for those of you who teach mindfulness. It's about a 70-page book in pretty large print. It probably would take you an hour to read it. And yeah, I believe it's called 10 Breaths to Happiness. And he describes his discovery of the practice as a time he was in his garden and he looked up. He just happened to be in his garden and he looked up and he saw this beautiful crescent moon that was framed by the bare branches of a buckeye tree on a crisp February day, just like we have today, in his backyard. And he decided just to take 10 conscious breaths while looking at this beautiful scene. And he said he just felt nourished in a way that felt just a little bit new to him. And it was a small, pleasant feeling, and then he just continued doing what he was doing. But because of that feeling that he had when he stopped and just took time to really notice, he kept using the practice to recognize and cultivate other times of joy and happiness. So the 10 breaths practice is a very simple way to use conscious, rhythmic breathing to help us savor life's precious moments and to live more fully. And it's a concrete way of bringing mindfulness off the cushion, off the chair, into our everyday lives and watering the seeds of joy. So it's very simple. When something good or beautiful or wonderful touches us in some way, can be in the sensory world or it can be a wonderful interaction with a partner, it can be sight, it can be sound, it can be the feeling of intimacy in connection with another, what we do is we stop and we offer it our full presence for the length of 10 breaths so that we can really taste the experience. So in order to do this, though, we use kind of an alternative way of counting because we want to really be able to focus on the experience itself rather than the counting. So what I often do, whether I'm standing or sitting, and I'll stand so that... So, you know, it can be kind of tricky counting and taking something in. So I use my fingers. Sometimes I use one hand and sometimes I use both hands. And I'll often put them right on my thighs. Or I might do this even. I put them together. And so I start with my thumb, and let's say I love that picture in the back room. I might be standing in front of it, really appreciating the art and the beauty of it. And so I press my thumb. Just took one in-breath and out-breath, and I press my first finger, my forefinger. One in-breath and out-breath. Then my second finger, that very special finger. One in-breath and out-breath. Then my third finger. And then my little finger. And then sometimes I'll use my other hand and do exactly the same thing on the other thigh. Or I'll just start back with the little finger and proceed back the way I came. So it's the reason we do that, of course, is not to get caught in the counting, because we can only pay one attention to one thing at our time. And now what I've noticed with this practice is that I have begun to notice the opportunities for touching the preciousness of life more. In some ways, it's almost like a gratitude practice. You know, and it really is about cultivating new pathways and happiness, the moments that can present themselves for this each day. So, like all meditative practices, this is a way to stop, open our heart, and savor what we love in the world, to let in the good, to let in the good. And it's a great way, again, to create new neural pathways in our brain by consciously feeding and watering the seeds of joy. And the reason that it's 10 breaths rather than 3 or 5 is that neuroscientists have found that it takes about 30 seconds of stimulation to firmly root a new neural pathway. Isn't that great? That's all it takes. So, you know, if you're practicing the skill of pausing and refraining throughout your day that we talked about last night, you can use 3 breaths for that. 3-5 breaths. But to really savor something, I'm suggesting the 10 breaths, because that's what neuroscience has shown it takes. So something catches our eye. Something touches our heart. Good feelings arise. And a lot of times this happens in the walking meditation, because the world of senses arise more vividly, especially if we walk outside. So in the walking, we're opening our eyes and the world of sight opens, the world of contact and movement arises with our steps, the sounds come more alive. And of course, if we're outside, nature helps with this process. And we can, in the walking, we can make any or all of the senses our home base. The pressure of our feet, the images, the smells, the sounds of the natural world, which are often so beautiful. So we can pause when something strikes us as beautiful or interesting and fully offer ourselves to the experience, fully give it our complete attention with 10 breaths. And it's in the walking that we often learn how to be increasingly attentive and mindful about what happens with contact with sensory objects. And it's where we learn to understand this contact. And again, what's so interesting, that is where we can learn how to work with the textures of pleasant and unpleasant. It's just as powerful, and even more powerful sometimes than the sitting practice, because we learn that as we see and hear the world arise, that the inner world arises in response to it. Good feelings arise, and we can train ourselves to fully experience one or more of these moments with the practice. So it's a simple way of helping us understand that happiness isn't something random in nature. Sometimes we tend to think of happiness like we think of good weather. You know, it's sometimes it's here and sometimes it's not. But it is something that can be cultivated. And that's what the 10 breaths practice is for. And, you know, if you work with children, they understand this practice. And like other very simple practices in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, it's a whole, or what we call a whole organism practice. So what I mean by that is that we bring our bodies and minds together in a focused way to be really present for life. So often our thinking minds, right, are in one place and our bodies are in another. And in meditation, you know, one of the ways to bring body and mind back together is to just focus ourselves on the physical sensations of the breathing. And so the 10 breaths practice is something that tries to use the breath as a bridge that connects body and mind in response to something that we're really enjoying. So let's just try it. So again, settle into a comfortable but dignified and stable position. Bring your awareness to your body by focusing your attention on the sensations of touch and contact. Put your hands on your thighs. Starting with the thumb of your dominant hand. In and out. Your first finger. Pressing your second finger down. The third, and the little finger. You could also move your hand to your heart if you wish, and go backwards on your finger, or use your non-dominant hand. Do exactly the same process. So go ahead. So we've got time for a few questions, if anybody has any. Please. Oh, Janet's coming with the mic. Right up in the front row.
Thank you. So it's sort of one sort of ancillary question and then one primary. I feel like I've designed that purple brace you use in my own more painful meditations a couple times. And I'm just wondering if it's something of your own design or if it's something that's available.
It's available. I did not design it. I saw somebody else using it just as you did. It's called Not a Chair, NADA. It's a takeoff on Not a Chair. And I actually discovered it for sitting on the ground watching my kids' soccer games when they were little, because it gives a brace to your back and you can clip the knees and it's just really stable. And then when I started developing back problems, I started using it for meditation, both sitting on a cushion and moving away from the back of a chair. Mm. So you can Google it, or I actually got mine before the internet. So you call the number in the phone book, an 800 number, and some woman answered and sent them out from her house. I'm sure it's gotten to be a much bigger business now.
Awesome, thank you. My second question: is it possible to? We were talking about rerouting neural pathways, and you're talking about it in terms of rerouting them from a positive, from a joy aspect. Could you also use that with a difficult person? Like, could you use it to, on the first breath, like sort of drink them in and feel the aversion, and then as you go through the 10 breaths, could you use it to, on the second breath, find something nice about their face on the third,
Well, of course, that's experimenting, That's like applying the practice in the real world, and that's a very creative way to apply it. I often think of it as sort of a helpful gratitude practice, and I often think of what you're talking about as sort of a pausing and refraining practice that I might use 3 breaths with, because whoever I'm interacting with might wonder why I'm taking 10 breaths. The practice is very mobile, and it's like a toolkit, and you can pull different things out when you need it. And so, yeah, that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think that's a wonderful way of dealing with aversive people. I'm going to remember that one.
Thanks. I was actually using sort of flashing faces of my sangha.
Yeah.
So it wasn't one person. It was just sort of like, oh, and them. Yeah. Oh, and them.
And that's sort of a bridge with the metta practice that La taught with a challenging person yesterday, too, that might be really, it's just great.
Oh, he was in there. I brought him in. I let him in. Thank you.
You're welcome. Back there, Janet.
I've been thinking a lot about what you said yesterday about watering the seeds of joy, and how I've been trying to cultivate that in my life for a little while now, and how hard it is to really follow through on the things that I'm passionate about or interest me, and just for me, for no one else. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if you could speak to the discipline kind of in a bigger way. I know that there's small things that we can do, like the breath throughout the day, and they do connect to then these bigger things like signing up for sailing, like you did. But I find that like following through on like the sailing activities and like those sort of things are really sometimes difficult. And if you could just speak to that.
Sure. Well, this is where right effort in the practice comes in. And so right effort is both about extending effort as well as non-effort, really finding that balance. So if we're too tight and we tend to be somebody who's going to start achieving right away, which was me, right? I talked about that last night. And, I'm going to sit for 45 minutes if you have to carry me out of here. I'm waiting for that bell to ring. That's the end of the continuum where it might be really helpful to say, oh, wow, I do my life this way. How could I bring compassion and kindness to this moment? Oh. And so not feeling like it's a failure, but to actually love myself enough to shift my posture or move to a chair. So if we're too tight, We have to learn how to loosen it up, and not from a place of a deficit, but from a place of love, care, and compassion from our place. And then if we're too lax, we have to find a way to tighten it up. So if we're too lax, maybe I'm sitting in meditation and I have this fantasy, and I know I have this fantasy, but I'm just going to go with it, man, to make the eternal time of this meditation go. And besides, who's going to know, right? You know? So that might be a time to tighten it up a little bit. But in terms of daily life, and this I found to be really, really hard, because if you wait till you feel like doing things, you won't, right? You won't. And I'll tell you, the only way, and again, this is why where you have to hold two worlds at once in some ways, because it sounds paradoxical. But the only way I've found to take care of that is to consciously plan. And so even when I was working a straight six on, three off shift, I would plan to get together with good friends. I'd get it in the calendar. You know, I would get a class in the calendar that I wanted to take. And now that I have more space, that I'm self-employed and I can set my schedule up any way I want, I have my 2015 schedule and I'm putting things in that I want to do. The things that I really want to do for 2014 were put in there in 2013, and then everything's planned around that. Now things come up and it doesn't always work out, but you know, it's so important to engage in the activities that water the seeds of joy. That's as much a part of our practice as anything else. So what are those Zen activities for you? What are those activities where you're just absorbed in the moment for the moment and consciously plan them? There's a question over here.
Microphone.
Hi.
Closer.
Okay. So last night, in your session, Sherry, you were talking about how burnout is when you're giving more than you have to give, mm-hmm. and I've been pondering that since last night, both with respect to relationship with my mother, as well as my work, and I work on women's rights. In a hierarchical, bureaucratic organization, that there's tension there. And I'm just wondering, so then I was pondering today, like, what do I have to offer? Mm-hmm. Rather than what do I not have to offer, what do I have to offer? And I identified things that there is a tension between what I have to offer and what people are ready to receive. So how do you approach that, and how do you deal with that in social justice work and in relationships?
Well, what you learn to do is, your advantage is always that you know the language of the arena you're in. So I've never talked about meditation and mindfulness much when I'm working with criminal justice professionals, but I know how to translate their language into... And I know the language of this practice, so I try to put the language of this practice into here. So, for example, I did a training early on when I started to realize that, my gosh, we're really good at training officers in the physical tools to do their job in terms of keeping themselves and other people safe, but we're losing people emotionally, not physically. So how can I help train them? And I'm not talking about basic sort of health and wellness, sleep more, eat better, da da da. But how can I train them to keep themselves emotionally safe? And what I did is I looked at my career, and I looked at sort of the biological effects of the career and the hypervigilance required, and did an in-service on the emotional effects of that job on us over time. And they loved it so much that they started asking if they could bring their spouses, and some of the retired people showed up because they really wanted to understand what had happened to them over time, and they realized that they were feeling depressed and listless, and that I would never talk about secondary traumatic stress. I would translate the language into, hey, these incidents can really have an impact on us. I talked about the biological roller coaster that can happen. So I really used myself as an imprint, and I thought about the kind of workplace that I wanted to live in and how I could be, I mean, I don't want to sound trite about it, but as Gandhi said, be the change I'm looking to create. So I got my team together and I said, hey, I know that it's the politics of the workplace that really impact people more than anything else. I mean, this is like being back in high school, but all of us have guns, for crying out loud, you know? Like, that's a scary thought. So what if, you know, so I was thinking about element of the Noble Eightfold Path and the precept around right speech. And I didn't say we need to use right speech and stop speaking in a less adversarial manner, but I said, what if we made an agreement that if we had a complaint about somebody else, that we were going to bring it to the group or bring it to the person who could actually do something about it and not go and sit behind closed doors and try to recruit each other to our viewpoints? But we can only do this if we all agree to it. So if we don't all agree to it, and if we're not all willing to police it with ourselves and each other, let's not agree to it. So I just put it out there. They loved it. You know, I'm talking about cops. If I can do it with cops, you can do it with whatever arena that you're in. So I just started thinking about, and you know, this is a, I've got two books in mind. One is sort of my memoirs and the lessons that they kind of taught me, little police vignettes. And the other one is, how do we bring the Eightfold Path into organizational life? How do we do this? So look for the book. But I mean, I really started looking at the entire Noble Eightfold Path and how I applied this to my life in organizations. But in a way, you know, that I will, you know, in a way that I think anybody could understand. Right livelihood. You know, for example, why do we think that bigger is better? Why do we never question that in nonprofits in a way that leads to these caseloads for people that lead to burnout in such a ridiculous way? There's so many ways that we step into the zone of fire that we do have control over. So that's just an inkling. But don't try to change other people. Just be who you want to be. And I guarantee you other people will start responding and they'll get very curious. I think we're out of time. And we have some announcements here. The airport shuttle sign-up is on the board. Please sign up before 12 o'clock today. If you need to leave early, please write Janet a note, and you'll need to meet with her before you leave. And please come to the 6:45 sit tomorrow morning. We start our closing announcements then. And there is yoga today at 3 p.m. If you didn't have it yesterday, when your last name begins with M, through Z, you have yoga today at 3 p.m. And the other thing is we have, of course, group interviews again today at 11:30 and 4:30. And if you would please make every effort to get there as soon as possible. And what we're going to do is we're going to end the sits before those, at least 5 minutes early. And what we'd like you to do is let the people who have groups leave the meditation hall first so that they can use the bathrooms or do whatever they need to get to their group. And, you know, again, I really want to invite you. We're getting a little lackadaisical about it. We might want to tighten up our effort here a little bit in terms of getting to group meetings and sits on time. What does it take to water different seeds so you're not rushing in here at the last minute? You know, again, so much of this is such an opportunity to change habitual behavior and cultivate new ways of being. So, but thank you. The meditation room has been so still. It's really a tribute to your practice. Thank you for your practice, and enjoy your day.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.